You are listening to the Tour des Flâneurs, the cycling podcast at the 2022 Tour de France, powered by Super Sapien, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Stage 11, today we're in Col du Grénon.
Well, I'm up here at the finish and Jonas Vingegaard is 150 meters to go, and there's been a lot of cheers when Pogacar went out the back. There's also been a lot of cheers anytime a Frenchman has been put on TV, be it Bardet or even when Gaudu caught up to Pogacar and passed him. But here comes Jonas Vingegaard for stage win and the yellow jersey. And you can hear the crowd going crazy up here. And he looks exhausted. We've got Quintana coming in for second place, an awesome ride from him. I think Le Pecheur has grown wings. Jonas Vingegaard is going to take yellow, and Pogacar is still 2 minutes away from the finish of this climb.
Well, we heard you there, Boz, 500 meters from the finish line of stage 11 of the Tour de France, which is people are already calling a historic day. Did it feel historic when you were standing there?
In a way it did. You know, it's funny, being at the top of the climb, there were moments when I didn't really know. I guess I was riding when, you know, a lot of the action was actually taking place on the Galibier, but, you know, just, I guess, witnessing, you know, the last climb, I very quickly realized that, you know, what we were all seeing was a historic moment. And it was interesting as we heard to hear the different cheers as, you know, a French rider came on TV, but specifically when Pogacar was going out the back, how a lot of people started cheering pretty loudly, which was a little bit surprising to me because I had always thought he was a popular character. But I think people are happy to see the race kind of coming back into level of dynamic racing.
Oh yeah, the French will always cheer the underdog, or you know, the guy coming from behind, or you know, it's kind of the Poulidor syndrome, you know, like you cheer Poulidor instead of Anquetil. Those historical references to kind of imply that I've seen a lot of historical stages in my career. So yeah, I mean, we you know, only time will tell how historical this day was, because tomorrow could be historic as well. We never know. You know, it was really exciting. One of the most exciting stages we've seen for a long time. We were all hoping at the start of the Tour de France that there'll be a real battle from Ineos and from Jumbo-Visma to try and topple Tadej Pogacar, like a sort of guerrilla you know, race against the reigning champion. And yeah, he was toppled today, and that's in itself is quite an amazing moment. We never suspected, you know, that Pogacar would fail that badly today.
Well, we should actually find out what actually happened. So let's play into my tale of the attack. Well, stage 11 billed as the first of the big Alpine tests, and what a test lay in store for the riders. 151.7 kilometres, finishing with a triple whammy of Col du Telegraph, Galibier, ending with a summit finish at the fearsome Col du Granon, site of Bernard Hinault's final ever day in yellow back in 1986. An attack by Wout van Aert and Mathieu van der Poel kicked off proceedings, which quickly multiplied into a 20-strong move. The peloton seemed content to let them go, and they quickly gained 4 minutes by the time they reached the spectacular hairpins of the Lacé de Montvernier. It was here that van der Poel was dropped, his last action of what has been a tumultuous race for him, as he abandoned soon after. Oliver Nason also abandoning. The brakes split on the ascent of the Telegraph, leaving only 10 at the front. Notable among them, Van Aert, Warren Barguil, and the King of the Mountains jersey, Simon Geschke. And they extended their lead to over 9 minutes on the peloton. With Mark Hirschi falling away and sensing further weakness in Pogacar's support entourage, Jumbo-Visma set about attacking the yellow jersey from long range. Primoz Roglic dragging Jonas Vingegaard away from the rest before Adam Yates clawed them back. Jumbo-Visma's strategy would set the tone for the rest of the stage. Relentless, powerful attacks from their ranks soon whittled the group of GC contenders right down, isolating Pogacar and Geraint Thomas. The quartet that were left refused to play nice. Vingegaard fired off the first blistering attack. When that was nullified by the yellow jersey, though, it was the turn of Roglic to put the boot in. But Pogacar was far from lost, putting in his own dig. All the while, Thomas was riding at his own tempo to regain contact. In an attempt to help Pogacar, Marc Soler bridged across, but it wasn't long before others did the same, bringing with them team reinforcements and new contenders, among them Romain Bardet and Nairo Quintana. While there was a brief truce in the GC group, at the front of the race, Barguil set off on his own, splintering the remainder of the breakaway and cresting the Galibier first to wrestle the polka dot jersey from Geschke. With the altitude on the Galibier hitting 2,000 metres, Roglic struck again, but Pogacar refused to allow his countryman any leeway. In fact, for this yellow jersey, attack is the best form of defence, and only Vingegaard could stay on his wheel. It seemed that the balance had swung back in Pogacar's favour, but Wout van Aert was still up ahead, ready to help his Jumbo teammate. Some yo-yoing in the GC group eventually saw a regrouping on the descent. Once van Aert was caught, he dropped right back and, like a locomotive, brought Roglic back into the fray, ready for the finale on the Granon. Up front, Barguil's hopes of a third Tour de France stage win looked promising with his pursuers falling away. Rafa Majka policed the GC group in support of the yellow jersey, and Nairo Quintana was allowed to slip away with no immediate response. The Colombian quickly became second on the road to his Arkea Samsic teammate Barguil, who was beginning to flag. Romain Bardet then made his move, gaining some ground, and with no reaction, Vingegaard launched an attack of his own. Incredibly, after so much resilience up to now, Pogacar faltered and showed his first sign of weakness at this tour so far. Ahead, Quintana passed Barguil to take the lead of the stage with 4.4 kilometres to go, but the fireworks behind continued, Vingegaard firing through and eating into Quintana's new advantage. Behind, it was open season on a floundering Pogacar, Thomas cruising past him, and then Yates, and then Gaudu as well. Riding like a man possessed, Vingegaard passed Bardet and then Quintana, opening up a minute lead over Pogacar. The Dane was totally unrelenting though, crossing the finish line solo. Incredible damage done to Pogacar, the defending champion ceding 3 minutes and 1 second in one unforgettable day. Bardet now is second on GC at 2 minutes 16 and Pogacar third at 2 minutes 22.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2022 Tour de France, powered by Super Sapien. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insight, and personalized analytics. We are here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success.
Thank you very much to Super Sapiens, title sponsors of the Cycling Podcast. And we're delighted to share with you that they've started their own podcast, the Super Sapiens Podcast, hosted by Zylon van Eyck and Dr. David Littman. Here's a clip from a recent episode when they were joined by pro rider for SD Works, Ashley Moorman-Passio.
With endurance efforts, I saw that what I was doing in the past, I was having massive like spikes and dips, you know. So I was able to try some different things and then to realize or to find the foods that helped me to kind of maintain my sugars more stable in endurance rides. And interestingly enough, for me, sweet potato is the secret to maintaining sugar levels. But I've spoken to someone else who said sweet potato gives them massive spikes. Found some great recipes from like Hannah Grant, who really, she's the guru when it comes to baking with sweet potato. So yeah, from sweet potato chocolate brownies to sweet potato and banana breads.
Find out more about Super Sapien's system of continuous glucose monitoring, which can help tailor your fueling and training for success. Go to supersapiens.com.
Well, Francois, we're at the second press buffet of my tour, your 736th today. We're at the base of the, we're in Briançon, getting ready. Well, I'm going to go climb the Granon. I'm in my kit at the moment. What sort of advice do you have to tell me? I've got, well, you can explain what's on my plate.
Yeah, you took a little bit of ham, a little bit of tapenade, which is a kind of, olive kind of cream. You took a what is there, blueberry tart or something, and I don't know exactly, oh, crumble maybe. So lots of sugar there. Is it what you need to tackle the granule?
Yeah, no, I didn't. It actually looks like a pretty good lunch today, but I kind of went light because I'm trying to get up there quick. But they did have wine today, so I'm going to have a little half pour of wine before we head off. And I did pick up some Haribo for the climb in case I get hungry up at the top. But it's warm down here in Briançon. It's, I think, 30 degrees as we pulled in, and just going to keep getting warmer. Probably a little bit cooler on top. No, I'm looking forward to it. We'll see what's on top. And yeah, it's probably going to be a lot of fans up there today. So we'll see what we find.
Well, we're all aware of what a massive challenge the Col du Granon would be for the riders, but obviously it turned out to be a challenge for the journalists as well. Boz, what was your experience as a journalist this time?
It was very unique in the sense, you know, this was my second day, and I feel like yesterday I was around the paddock early on and just getting a sense of like how you can kind of throw your mic out there, regardless if you're asking the questions or not. And today, as we heard, I decided to ride up the climb, and I got to the top, and once up there, I realized that I was the only journalist up there, which was really surprising. And I guess for a while, I've read something a while back that Albert Einstein had this option paralysis where he had seven pairs of clothes that were all identical because he didn't want to choose what he had to wear that day. And I guess at the finish line, I kind of felt like, oh my goodness, there are so many riders here, and they're all, especially at the top of a climb, they're all vulnerable. They're all tired. They're all hanging over their bars. And I'm like, I'm the only person here to speak to them. And you know, for a while I was like hesitating, like, who do I speak to? Who should I grab? Which is a unique experience. It was, you know, really, you know, for myself, it was fantastic to be one of the only people up there. But, you know, I guess I find myself sometimes in a funny position as well, because a lot of these riders are my friends or, you know, former colleagues. So, you know, I am behind a mask. So they don't always instantly recognize me, but some of them do. And it's always nice to be recognized. And then I feel like I have a little insight into putting a microphone in their face.
Francois, you didn't fancy it. You didn't fancy a trip up as well on your bike.
No, the problem is, I've never ridden a bike in my life. I mean, I have ridden bikes from time to time, but I'm not, you know, I was a runner. I've never been a very good rider at any stage of my life. So there was no way, and especially Le Granon, which is called the monster. We talked about monsters a lot in this podcast this year, but yeah, it's called le monstre du Briançonnais, the Granon. So, you know, there was a suggestion and from some colleagues that, you know, we should all buy e-bikes and actually use them to go to the finish these days, because Jumbo Visma had a plan, it worked fine. We had a plan and it worked fine. I'm pretty proud of ourselves. I mean, because the idea of sending Ian riding to the top of the Granon meant we're the only media who really had, you know, direct quotes from the guys at the finish, which was, you know, kind of a bold move, because we're not even sure that you would be allowed to record up there. But I think we made the right move, and that's great. I must say that, well, we must go back to the context a little bit. As we said, you know, the last couple of days, COVID, you know, resulted in the fact that you know, the paddock is locked down. The access to riders is restricted. So we have to find ways to get to the riders, to talk to the people in the race bubble. And well, our little plan of the day was great, I think.
Yeah, we spoke last night about Francois being the team leader, and we have a good one. He implemented a great plan today. Maybe Jumbo Visma will hire him up for next year's tour.
Well, exactly. I was going to say, whose plan was better today, the cycling podcast or Jumbo Visma? Because it really was a team plan working out to perfection, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. You know, I was able to speak to a number of Jumbo Visma riders at the finish. And, you know, there was a stark contrast between all their emotions, you know, all the teammates as they rolled into the top, and, you know, various other teams and riders at the top. You know, in particular, UAE looked like a very broken team. You know, and I actually did some reconnaissance last night. We looked at the Strava, and I had noticed that the time up the climb was actually relatively slow compared to, you know, what's possible. And so I had assumed that a lot of riders hadn't actually ridden the climb, but as we'll hear, you know, Jumbo actually had come here as a team to recon the climb. They may have just not posted on Strava to not let people know.
Vingegaard said he had only done the you know, at least half the climb by car, and then he actually discovered Le Granon today, and he used an adjective, brutal, you know. So obviously, he was talking of tactics. you know, I know it's a cliche, but you know, the expression textbook cycling was actually the case today. I mean, everything went according to plan. Wout van Aert first, you know, to lead the way, and then turning into a domestic to lead the Jumbo Visma kind of train, Roglic being sacrificed for Jonas Vingegaard, well, knowing that, you know, you have such a great rider as Primoz Roglic, and you sacrifice a guy, you know, for the common good. I mean, all this was planned, and I guess the astonishing thing is that probably UAE and probably Pogacar knew that there was the plan, knew that it was bound to happen. He just couldn't do anything.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my thought coming into today, I guess coming into the fact, I guess in the Alps, thinking that Pogacar's best form of defense was going to be attacking. I mean, I thought on a day like today, you know, if he could distance himself and put, you know, or really isolate himself between one or two riders where he only had to look after, you know, maybe Vingegaal and G, then he would, you know, he could let riders go up the road if they were 5 or 6 minutes down. And I think we saw a bit of that on the Glen Dom where he was being really aggressive, but he was keeping things very controlled by himself, which is not an easy thing to do, especially, you know, coming down the Col de Lauderdale. It's a long, gradual downhill.
Yeah, you could tell things were going were not going according to plan for Pogacar when I think it was a little bit, not lack of experience, but I think the race was probably decided on the Galibier. You had all these attacks. And they played it like at one stage it was like a sprint event on track. You know, there were four of them. You could send the tactics, the intimidation going there. You know, and actually in many ways, Pogacar reacted like an amateur, like, you know, going for every move. Why did he go after Roglic when Roglic attacked a couple of times? Roglic was no threat for the GC, so he should have let him go. But you could feel, you know, that there was maybe a lack of confidence. In retrospect, I asked myself whether all this effort we've seen him doing at the end of stages, in the previous days, like grabbing 10 seconds here, 5 seconds there, were not actually motivated by a little lack of confidence, so maybe he's not in the shape we thought he was.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the illness that is potentially running around the team could also be playing a factor as well. But yeah, I mean, I think we said it last night that Pogacar finished at the front of the group, you know, of the, I guess, reduced peloton, which for me was a little bit odd that he's digging deep every day. But as Francois said, I mean, it's very seldom in recent tour history, really in recent cycling history, that we've seen so much aggression so often throughout this whole race. It's not just been today's stage, but the fact that, you know, 50K to go, that, you know, riders were attacking and going over the top, you know, one by one, or, you know, and it kind of regrouped on the backside, but, you know, the race was split to bits 50K to go.
Well, it has reminded me of Simon Yates at the Giro. Do you remember when he was kind of going for all these a few seconds here, a few seconds there in the first week, and managed to build up a decent lead, but then lost it all in one stage to Froome and lost the pink jersey. So I wonder do you think Tadej Pogacar is now suffering from those efforts that he's been putting in all week, or suffering from that kind of almost showboating when he, you know, Roglic was attacking, Vingegaard was attacking, and then Pogacar would attack even when he didn't need to? Do you think he paid for that on the final climb there?
The heat was definitely a factor. We know that Pogacar doesn't like the heat. And I mean, if we know Jumbo Visma knew as well, and all the others knew, so that's one factor. I mean, seeing him lose that much time in the final climb, you have to ask yourself whether, you know, there was not a problem with a kind of a hunger knock or something, but at the end of the day, he was asked repeatedly what had gone wrong, and he refused to say anything else but, you know, Jumbo Visma were the best today. He didn't look for excuses or, like, you know, fringale, as we say in French, or, you know, being tired from the other days or the heat or anything. Maybe he didn't want to give a clue to his opponents of what's going wrong, because if he does, then maybe tomorrow they'll act on it. I really think tomorrow will be a key. I mean, today was a key stage, but tomorrow we'll see whether it was un jour sans, you know, a day without, as we say, a bad day for Pogacar, or whether it is more serious than that. Tomorrow will be either the confirmation or the denial of the takeover by Vingegaard.
Yeah, and I swang by the Ineos bus on the way back, and I didn't record anything, but I was speaking to a director over there, Gabriel Rash, and was mentioning that this is, at least as far as I know, one of the first times that Pogacar has been dropped. You know, he just, you know, didn't lose a couple seconds. He really exploded and lost, you know, a significant chunk of time. And, you know, he's such a smooth and elegant rider more often than not. And you could just see he was suffering. You know, he was moving on his bike more. His jersey was unzipped. You know, he was really struggling today. And so it's a definite sign that, you know, it was a bad day, but it could be this leading into a, you know, a series of bad days potentially.
And the most important thing maybe for now is that Jumbo-Visma have exposed Pogacar's you know, weaknesses, but now the others know as well. I mean, Geraint Thomas did his race as he, you know, very consistently as he usually does, but now the Ineos Grenadiers know that if they in turn attack, you know, it might work as well. As we say, Romain Bardet now has ambitions. Other guys may feel like Nairo Quintana went for it. So they might, you know, this bad day could make things even worse for Pogacar, because others may, you know, may follow what suit from what Jumbo-Visma did today. And if he's attacked from all sides, it'll be really, really tough.
Well, I think I noticed a moment watching up at the top of the climb when David Gaudu caught back up to Pogacar and Yates was on his wheel and Gaudu came up. And I noticed, and I was just wondering what they were thinking, because so often these riders are behind Pogacar just waiting for him to attack. And there was a moment when I think Gaudu actually went ahead of him, and I think he was just like, and same with Geraint Thomas, he was looking back like, wait, Pogacar is behind me. Like, it's not just a small gap and he's going to close it. He's continuing to lose time. And I think for a lot of riders, they haven't seen that in the last couple of years, and not just the Tour, but any race or any time they've gone up against Pogacar.
Probably confidence booster for all these guys. The only thing being that Vingegaard was really impressive. If you know, if actually it is confirmed that Pogacar is fading a little bit, it is not Vingegaard's case. You know, maybe the mechanical and the problems Jumbo-Visma had on the cobbles were kind of made us believe that, you know, they were not as strong, and we lost sight of the fact that they were actually still there and more than ever, and we lost sight as well of how strong Jonas Vingegaard is. And well, today well, we know he's now the new favorite of the Tour de France. I'm not saying that Pogacar is finished, not by any means. And that's what Vingegaard said. Also, at the finish, it was nice to see Pogacar. He's a classy guy, you know. He really had a bad day today, and he went to congratulate Jonas Vingegaard, who was on his bike, you know, talking to his girlfriend and his parents on the phone. And you can see there's mutual respect. And Vingegaard said in the press conference that, well, that there's an exciting battle ahead. And as he said, that's the exciting battle we were all hoping for.
Yeah, I did make one observation at the finish line as well. And I've, you know, very seldom seen Pogacar after the race. And I assume, you know, he comes across as very, you know, happy, easygoing. But there was a cluster of people around him trying to push him back to the behind the podium, and he started yelling at people like, get out of my way, because I think he was, you know, clearly frustrated after the day. And I do wonder if this long term could potentially change the mindset of Pogacar. You know, it's really the first kind of on a big scale that he's had a bad day, and could it make him more of a potentially cynical rider going forward?
Well, shall we hear from Pogacar's teammate, Brandon McNulty? You caught up with him at the finish, Boz, didn't you?
I did, yes. And oddly enough, I was a little bit skeptical to speak to any UAE riders, just because I was wondering if I spoke to them, would other teams not want to speak to me, given the fact that, you know, they have had COVID cases within the team. But yeah, Brandon came across the line and, you know, we made eye contact and he instantly recognized me. And so I went over and had a chat with him. But oddly, when I first observed him, he was actually smiling and laughing. And I think in a sense, he has kind of understood that, you know, maybe they anticipated this more than we thought. So let's hear from Brandon McNulty.
Well, Brandon, I mean, I think you know the result that Pogacar lost the yellow jersey today, but he definitely went down with a fight. Was this a stage you guys had anticipated being a challenge?
Yeah, I mean, it's the first proper day, and we knew we're already weakened, losing a couple guys, and guys not feeling well. And so, yeah, I expected to come under full fire, and, yeah, it happened early on, and we all gave what we could, but in the end, yeah, the strongest guy obviously won today. So.
Well, and on the Galibier, Jumbo was trying to send Roglic up the road, but Pogačar wouldn't let him go. Was he a rider you knew you had to keep close?
Yeah, Primoz is always dangerous. I mean, you give him a minute and then maybe takes the descent and then it could escalate, blowing out really fast. Yeah.
Well, and knowing that there's still a lot of racing ahead and knowing Pogačar, you know, not having the pressure of defending yellow, do you guys think that, I mean, you know Pogačar better than I do. Does he have the ability to bounce back and give it a fight in the coming days and in the Pyrenees?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say 100% he'll try. I mean, whether he can do it or not, I don't know, but he'll try.
Congrats, man.
Thank you.
Well, so contrary to UAE, the Jumbo-Visma team was very ecstatic at the finish line. They were all smiling and giving each other fist bumps, and I was able to connect with a few of the riders and directors on the team. So we're about to hear from Steven Kruiswijk, American Sepp Kuss, and their director, Gries Nierman.
All right, Steven Kruiswijk, you guys have been at it for a while, and finally today, Jonas, he smashed it up that final climb, and you guys seemed like you had a plan all day.
We started with a plan. We know this stage was really, really hard, this one. We did a recon a few weeks ago, and already we said here maybe this would be really a stage that Jonas would suit because of the steepness and the altitude, and with that also the heat in the beginning of the race. Yeah, we decided also with Primoz we could play a bit. Maybe we could take some time out of or put the team of Pogačar under pressure, and I think we succeeded in that on the Galibier pretty well. With some attacks and some guys in the front. Yeah, on the last climb up to Jonas itself, and you see he was flying.
I mean, you have another big day tomorrow. I mean, Jonas has shown that he can recover well. But Pogačar really came apart today. Do you guys, I mean, you clearly have the team as well for the next couple of days?
Yeah, we've got a really strong team. I think you already saw that from stage number one, and great ambitions going for green stages and the yellow. And we lost Primoz a bit in the GC fight, but yeah, we see with Jonas, I think we are pretty good to defend him.
Well, I just spoke to Steven Kruiswijk, and then American guy, Sepp Kuss, came up. Dude, I mean, you got the whole team up here. You just rolled in with Roglic. I mean, this has been a long time in the work for the team.
You know, we knew Pogačar was, always the guy to beat, always super strong, but you have to believe in yourself and believe in the team that you can do it, and we had a plan today. You always have to see how it goes in the race, but to be able to more or less execute the plan and see Jonas just fly like we knew he could, it was really amazing.
I mean, I spoke to Kruiswijk, said you guys had recon this climb before. Was this a stage that you guys identified, or I mean, obviously there's a big stage again tomorrow, but was there something specific about this climb that you guys knew was possibly in your favor, or the stage in general?
We knew out of all the climbs in the tour, this was probably the one that suited Jonas the best, just long and steep. And with the Galibier coming before, it was a good chance to do something from a distance if we had the numbers. So, it was a good stage for that.
I mean, I guess a positive note as well is you guys still have a strong team here going forward, because you know we're only halfway through the tour, a big day tomorrow and some tough days before the next rest day. How are you and the whole team feeling about that now, defending yellow, which is a different strategy and different tactic,
different defending it, more pressure? But I think we've been in that position a lot in the tour and in the Vuelta and a lot of different races, so we kind of know how each other race, and I think we're confident for it.
A big day for the team, and it seems the environment, just a lot of happiness, I mean, at the top of the Grand On here.
Yeah, I think I'm really proud of the boys. This was really a team effort. The initial idea was to get Primoz ahead, to put UAE under pressure, but obviously Pogačar didn't want to let Primoz go. There was a real, real big fight on the Galibier already, and in the end, he had to pay for that, I guess, and Jonas came out as the strongest. And I think we played it really, really good, really well today. But thanks to the boys who displayed like big strengths, a big team effort.
Well, and it's been a long time in the making, in the sense that, you know, you guys have been slowly chipping away at this, and to now be in this position leading the Tour de France halfway through, I mean, how does that feel?
Yeah, it feels really, really good, of course. I mean, we were leading the Tour de France before, so we want to be leading it in Paris. That's the big goal, but for now it looks good. But of course, there are, how much is it? 10 really, really hard days coming up, and we see how that goes.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, we heard there from some of the members of the Jumbo-Visma team that you caught up with, Ian Boswell. But, of course, one of the other notable members of that team was your favourite, Francois, I should imagine, one of your monsters of cycling, Wout van Aert. You know, how integral was his part to play in today's stage?
He is a monstrous Swiss knife, you know. Like you can do it, because he's a guy. A Swiss
knife.
A green one. A Swiss knife is not a very, you know, luxury item. But is like a golden Swiss knife, you know, like or even, you know, I don't know how many, you know, carats you call diamond Swiss knife, because I mean, he can do everything. We've seen that from the start. He can do everything for himself and to win races for Jumbo. But today, he ran his own race at the first. I mean, breaking away with Mathieu van der Poel. Yeah, I mean that was. An exciting moment. We were, oh, what's going on? You know, we back to the old rivalry, and obviously it didn't last long. And it's the kind of dynamic that we have between Jumbo-Visma and UAE now. Well, that's the same dynamic between Wout van Aert and Mathieu van der Poel, who had the, you know, disastrous Tour de France and quit. You know, which is quite unfortunate, because we'd have loved to see him go a little bit further, but obviously he was not he was not in the pace. So he did that. He went to collect the points for the green jersey, and he was up the road for a long time with the breakaway and doing his part of the job. And you know, it's been a method. It's been a tactics launched by Movistar sort of for the last 10 or 15 years, to have a guy up front, and then he waits for the guys when they come back, and you know, he plays a sort of a kind of, you know, relay guy. And so, well, that's what we saw clearly. Wout van Aert almost stopped, you know, to wait for the Jumbo-Visma group to come. He looked back and, okay, now, you know, off to my domestic role, and then he was, you know, was really the locomotive. You know, he really, really pulled the train hard for as long as he could. And also at that there was one moment when he said, okay guys, I can't go no further, I've done my job. And you know, all this within the same stage is, you know, says a lot about the extraordinary. It's not the potential, the extraordinary palette of you know, yeah, qualities, and it's, yeah, always impressive, really impressive rider.
Yeah, when I noticed just the camaraderie within the team, you know, and you also have to think the fact that they came into that last climb with a number of riders, and Pogacar had one rider left to help him, and so you just think, you know, and also at the finish line, just seeing that all the teammates kind of waited for each other to show up, and UAE was at the finish line in bits, you know, Mikael Bjorg and Mark Hirschi were some of the last riders to come in, and they just came to the finish line and they sat down and they looked like crushed souls, and it was really kind of, I mean, I almost felt sad for, you know, for the team, because obviously they had such high expectations, you know, this would be the third tour in the row, and we still don't know what will happen, but I just really felt, as a rider who's been a part of a team, I really just felt sad to be part of, you know, or just to witness that they were, you know, not just Pogacar, but the whole team just was crushed today.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
One thing that we're all very excited about here at the Cycling Podcast is our project with our clothing partners, MAP. Now, we tasked them to create 3 brilliant jersey designs, and my, did they succeed at that. The brief was, what if the Cycling Podcast was a pro team? What would the jersey look like? The designer, Misha Glisevich, came up with 3 designs which reflect different eras of cycling history. The designs are called Check, Dot and Fade, and you can see them and vote for your favourite at map.cc. That's MAAP.cc. The winning design will go into production later in the year and will be available to buy. And a buffalo motif to remember Richard, who I know was really excited about this project, that will be added to the winning design. So this is MAP's designer, Misha Glisevich, talking about the ideas behind the project.
My name is Misha Glisevich. I'm the creative director at MAP. I'm one of the founding members. Ollie and Jared approached me when they were first starting the brand, or thinking about starting MAP, and approached me to kind of initially do the branding and overall brand direction, graphic aesthetic of the brand, and website design, which kind of evolved into the product design. For me, you know, having studied graphic design, my passion for cycling was always linked to the graphic design and the bold colors and the style of the riders, you know, so that they're two things that are always been linked for me. And I'm not sure which one is stronger, you know, but it's, or which one started first or which one appealed to me the most. But it's definitely something that's worked hand in hand over the years. We wanted to kind of create something that responds to the rich heritage of cycling and teams and the influence on teams on design, and kind of really look back at the different eras of cycling and present our brand and your brand as a fantasy team. For me, it was a different kind of process where, you know, usually I feel like a lot of map jerseys are rooted in me referencing old cycling kits and my love of the sport and, you know, heritage of cycling, but we do it in very subtle ways, you know, through color or placements or shapes. But this was kind of really a more direct interpretation of the eras and kind of looking at it more closely and identifying the elements of each era that kind of, you know, subconsciously makes you feel a connection to that time and those riders of each period.
Well, everyone, stage two of the Breakfast with Boz segment. I'm at the top of the Col de Grandon. It was a hard climb, hot at the bottom, and a very untraditional big climb you would find in the Alps. It was a much smaller, narrower road. Surprisingly, not a ton of fans on the side of the road, but it's hard, and I'm up here, and we're just seeing about 5K to go. Roman Bardet has just attacked, and I found a lot of Slovenian fans mid-climb, but clearly up here at the top, there are some French fans. And it's a beautiful, beautiful climb. Not quite as hard as I had thought, but still a challenging climb. And it was pretty windy up near the last 2K of the climb. So I think if any of the riders have any intel, they will try to create a gap before that, because in the last couple of K, it's going to be easier to follow in the wheels. For breakfast this morning, I was actually joined by Ed Pickering of Rouleur and Francois Tamazo. We decided to come over to Briançon and skip a morning ride. And I once again had an almond croissant. It was much better than the almond croissant I had the other day in Morzine. And I also had a quiche with tomatoes and olives. So once again, quite a good breakfast. Maybe I'm on a little almond croissant journey this tour. Some good energy up here. It seemed a little bit quiet for a while, but as the riders become closer, I feel like the anticipation and the excitement is building. So I'm going to get down near the finishing booth. I've just connected with a few soigneurs that I used to work with at Team Sky, so I should have a little bit of access to speak to some riders here. Quintana's off the front. Barguil's still off the front, and Bardet has just attacked. Maybe the French riders are unaware that Bastille Day is actually tomorrow.
Well, we heard there the second edition of, well, for the cycling podcast, because I know that it is a podcast in its own right, isn't it, Ian? But the second edition on the cycling podcast of Breakfast with Boz. And how did it compare to yesterday's nice, cruisy, easy, pretty alpine views?
It was a hard climb. We mixed things up a little bit this morning as well. We actually had breakfast in Megève. Francois joined me and yeah, I had another almond croissant that you'll hear was far superior than what I had the other day. It was a much harder climb, I guess. It was also much warmer than it was yesterday. You know, yesterday I left at 6:45 in the morning, and today was maybe 2 p.m. So it was much warmer outside. But it was a really hard climb, and we'll hear about it. But I also noticed that there's literally no cover on the climb. You know, you go through a town at the base of the climb, but once you get past the town, there are no trees, you know, almost like a mini Mont Ventoux. You know, it's very exposed. It was a little bit windy, but you can also see a long way. You can, for in the middle of the climb, there's a series of switchbacks, and you can really see up ahead. And, you know, from the vantage point of being up high, and we noticed that actually Vingegaal was at times looking down the climb because you can see a long way through the switchback. Well, and Francois, there's a lot of history to this climb. What else can you tell about it?
So as we know, because we've said it repeatedly, it had not been ridden by the Tour de France since 1986, which was my first tour. So maybe my first and last tour, so we have to come to the Granon. But the 1986 one, it was won by Eduardo Chozas, and a Spaniard who was, you know, in the break that day. But it's also famous because it was the last day Bernard Hinault, you know, held the yellow jersey. He had to actually, you know, handed over definitely to Greg LeMond that day, and then, you know, the next day they were going to L'Alpe d'Huez. It has exactly the same stage that we're going to see tomorrow, and yeah, it was the passing of the baton, and as everybody knows, Hino and Le Mans in L'Alpe d'Huez, you know, went over the line, and, you know, hand in hand, and it was often said, you know, that it was one of the hardest climbs it done. Yeah, he also said he had an injury, he had a calf injury, he didn't feel really good on that climb, but if you ask him, you know, I tried to call him today actually, because usually he talks to me. I nearly recorded the sound of his answering machine, you know, but obviously he was, I suppose he was snowed under request, you know, to discuss his last day in yellow, so he didn't reply. But you would never, you know, lead, you know, to admit he really had a failure. He said, well, you know, it was I had pledged to help Greg win the tour, so that was the day when I decided that it was time for him to go for it. So, you know, that's, you know, never admitting defeat. There was another interesting feature about the Granon. So we really don't really know why this pass exists, you know, because it leads nowhere. But I think it was obviously for military purposes, because at the top of it you've got two forts, so obviously, you know, they build the road so that the military could go up to the forts and you know, and watch the border with Italy. Another important thing, yesterday were demonstrators for, you know, against climate change, and, you know, environmental concerns are important and an important matter even for the tour organizers, for the Tour de France. And today, actually, one of the reasons why we couldn't go up to the finish was that there was a deal made with the local authorities that no cars would be going up there, that no litter would be, you know, thrown from cars or whatever, that, you know, spectators would be limited, and there were even areas that they hired a specialist, a botanist, to say, okay, you can't go there, we have to protect that area. So one of the reasons also why we had to send Buzz up the hill was only to protect the site. So that's, you know, that's also a nice interesting little feature of the Granon.
Yeah, I mean, I was incredibly surprised at just how little things were actually up there. And actually, speaking of the military, there were quite a few, I guess, I don't know what, border defense military up there, because they must still keep an active base up there, and they're actually on display, maybe trying to recruit people, handing out pens, and they had some machine guns out, and they're all in this a unique green and white camouflage, maybe because I assume they get a lot of snow in the wintertime. But it was really a small area for everyone. I mean, the teams were only allowed, I mean, obviously the team cars could go up, but only one small sprinter van for the soigneurs, and there was very little parking, and, you know, oftentimes, I mean, we'll see this tomorrow at Alpe d'Huez, it's a circus up on top, and really everyone who wanted to make it to the top was either by foot or by bicycle. There was no additional cars at the top outside of the Finnish infrastructure, and then the few teams that brought one vehicle up.
I mean, is that part of the reason why the tour hasn't visited, or is it just that French race organizers are very superstitious? They wouldn't possibly want, you know, a French great like Bernard Hinault losing his final yellow jersey there. They wouldn't want to go back to somewhere with that kind of bad luck.
It was actually the decision by the local authorities. They didn't want such a big race as the Tour to go up Le Granon and destroy, or because actually they had bad memories in 1986, not only because Hino lost the yellow jersey, but also because crowds kind of, you know, destroyed really protected areas, so that they were very reluctant for the Tour to get back there, and the only reason why we could get back there is because they imposed those regulations, which are not, you know, very handy for us journalists, but, you know, let's face it, with the COVID restrictions and the protection of the environment are much more important than a few quotes you can grab at the finish line when you're a journalist.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the 2022 Tour de France. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to our sponsors, Science in Sport. The Cycling Podcast is very much powered by them in more ways than one. As Lionel mentioned a few episodes ago, a couple of our producers, Hugh and Adam, rode the Etap up Alpe d'Huez at the weekend. And you can hear more about that in the Kilometre Zero episode that comes out tomorrow morning. But Science in Sport products made up the bulk of their fueling for that. I've heard that cappuccino and tiramisu bakes, Go Energy powder and gels and cola-flavoured hydro tablets to keep the cramps away really were their big hits. So if you're looking for some sports nutrition and a fantastic offer to boot, then head to scienceinsport.com and use the code SISCP25 for 25% off all of their products. Well, today's stage, even though it was just the first of many Alpine days, it felt like such a definitive day. I mean, you guys look like you're having a lovely time, kind of exhausted from your own exploits out there, sitting beautiful vistas, couple of cans of beer there. Can I see? Tell us what you're drinking there.
Well, Mitch would be very disappointed with our beer selection tonight. I will say, Mitch would probably not even drink this. But
no. Well, the thing is, I went to the nearest supermarket to buy beer. There were a couple of local craft beers, but they were so warm that I settled for the only cool ones I could find, which are very average industrial stuff. But just to name a few bottles I've seen on the on my on. My trip to the supermarket was one called there's the Bière du Mont Blanc, the Mont Blanc, the highest peak in Europe. So there's apparently a brasserie that makes beer there, and there was a funny one called la Bière du Crétin des Alpes. So it means what it means, the beer of the cretin of the Alps, but I mean, the cretin of the Alps is not a joke. It's actually apparently for many decades in the Alps, because there were isolated villages and isolated valleys, while people, how could I put it mildly, tend to make kids with their cousins, and it resulted into a syndrome that's a real medical syndrome called Alpine cretinism. You had guys who had this kind of mental disease, and it's not a joke. It's called Alpine cretinism, and so
obviously, and there's a beer named after it.
Yeah. So some guys had the idea of having a beer called the Beer of the Cretins of the Alps. Well, there you are. We haven't tested it, but I might go back tomorrow, buy a bottle, put it in the fridge, and we'll tell you what it tastes like.
Oh my God! I think maybe in future, maybe just stick to wine. I think lay off the beers.
Yeah. Well, the area is not renowned for its wines. I mean, further north in Savoy, you've got the Mondeuse, and you've got wines made of Pinot and Gamay. But here in Briançon, we're already in Provence. So I mean, this area is not noted for its wines. But if you just go down like 80 or 100 k's, you start to get in the Provence region. And as everybody knows, Provence is noted worldwide for its rosés. So I'd recommend, if you're in Briançon, maybe to go for a rosé. I know that the purists don't like rosé. They say, oh, it's not wine, it's just a drink or something. I'm not against rosé. I think rosé can be very good wine, but you just have to pick the good ones. And just rosé de Provence doesn't mean much. If you really want to be on the safe side with rosés, go for the rosés made in the region of Aix-en-Provence. And they usually, the appellations are very simple. Coteau d'Aix-en-Provence or Palette, but all the roses made in that area are really good, actually. So if you're in a wine shop or in a supermarket and you're looking for cool rosé for your go for the Aix-en-Provence stuff.
I mean, if you're in a wine shop, but it's a good time to remind everyone that we do have the Cru de Flaneur collection of wine. I can't say how many rosés from Provence fit in there, but that was curated by Greg Andrews at Divine Cellars, and that is still available. So if you're interested in that, or interested in wine, well, I mean, and who wouldn't be interested in wine, then go to divinecellars.com and see the selection of wines. And they've done a collection there that is going to tell the story of the 2022 Tour de France. And also, Daniel's got a podcast with Greg as well, which is on the feed and was released just before the tour. If you're if you're looking for that. But I mean, you guys look very relaxed, but you know, tonight the riders won't be relaxed, will they? Because there's a huge test in the form of Alpe d'Huez tomorrow.
Yeah, well, and speaking of someone who does enjoy their wine and knows their French wine very well, that's Romain Bardet. And Francois spoke to him yesterday, and lo and behold, he had a phenomenal day today. And tomorrow, we should also remind everyone that tomorrow is also Bastille Day. And there was a moment today when I thought the French riders have the day off, because there was a lot of very active French riders today, with Barguil up the road and Bardet having a good day. Romain up to second overall on GC.
As you know, I'm not chauvinistic at all. My favorite champions have never been French, but yeah, it's nice to see some of the local guys coming back. I mean, Barguil had a couple of very bad years, you know, crashes, injuries. So I mean, he was up the road for a long while, and it's nice to see him trying again. And Romain Bardet, as we know, changed teams, also had his problems. Went with DSM, and well, was in splendid form in the Giro and had to pull out with stomach problems. So yeah, there was a very nice picture at the end of the if you were watching the TV coverage, there was a sudden glimpse of Bardet sitting by himself at the top of the cliff and looking down in the valley, like contemplating that the 2 years he might have not lost, you don't lose years, but and maybe contemplating a new future. It would be really nice to see Bardet in the on the podium in Paris, but it's a long way to go yet.
Yeah, I mean, and I know Romain fairly well. He bought a place, I think, in Vence, not too far from Nice. So when he was living down there in the winter, we would train together. And he's an incredibly nice guy, and he's incredibly thoughtful and caring. And I was just at the finish line, and I looked over and I saw him sitting on this in a gorgeous vista behind him. It was just nothing behind him, and just, I'm sure he wasn't looking at the view, but it was just so romantic. It was a perfect, he had gone outside of the finish, the taped off area, so everyone could kind of rush over and see him. And it was very emotional, I guess, even for me to see him there and to see how good of a ride he had done, and to realize that he had, climbed the ladder and was up to second overall. Well, and so I wasn't able to get a hold of Romain at the finish, but I was able to speak to his sports director. And I believe Matt Winston is also a team coach. So we spoke to Matt, or I spoke to Matt at the finish. So let's hear from him.
I'm here with Matt Winston from Team DSM. I mean, phenomenal ride today from Bardet.
Yeah, really good. We kind of said at the start of the race, we take it stage by stage, which is what we did. And we knew Romain was in good shape. And we, again, wanted to go for the stage result from the peloton. And Romain showed really good legs there. And yeah, in the end, third on the stage, moved up to second on GC. So yeah, I guess people are going to now think we're going for GC, which, yeah, of course, when we're in second, we're going to go for it there.
I mean, a phenomenal ride from Romain. And I mean, he's really thrived within this team. I mean, I think, coming back to the Tour is obviously a big deal for any French rider. But, moving away from a French team, but coming to a team that's maybe a little bit more, I mean, a different approach.
We've worked really hard with Romain over the last 18 months, and yeah, I think he's made some really nice steps, and he really enjoys working as part of this team. And I think when we continue to work in this way, then it's going in a really good direction.
I mean, so obviously he's up there in second in GC. I mean, he's got to focus on that over trying to go for a stage win, but maybe he can go for both at the same time.
Yeah, I think when it comes from the peloton, you never know when the opportunities might arise, and We'll look to it, and we'll still take it day by day. It's still a long way to go in this Tour. It's nice that we're in this spot now, but we're still a long way to go, and we're still a lot of hard racing to come. Tomorrow again, a super hard stage, and it can all turn on its head again by tomorrow evening. So we stand here now in a nice position, but yeah, we have to now keep the focus and go again tomorrow.
But as Matt said, the probably the most commonly used quote in cycling, we'll take it day by day, which really kind of caught me off guard, the fact that he said, Romain came here for stage wins, and I think the goal going forward is maybe still stage wins. But a rider in second in GC and having a day like he had today, looking ahead to tomorrow, surely he's got his mind set on the GC now.
Yeah, I hope he keeps lying about his ambitions day by day.
So what can we expect tomorrow? I mean, it's crazy that, to have a stage featuring the Alpe d'Huez and, to not even feel that might be the big decisive stage of the week already.
I mean, it is a really big day. And, what they actually go back over the Galibier, which is, a hard climb in itself. And then, they hit it, I think it's, 1,600 or 2,600 meters at the top? You know, so back up to altitude, down, and then a very similar run into, I think, a pretty traditional run into Alpe d'Huez, the Col du Croix de Fer, down, and then up the Alpe d'Huez.
Yeah, it's exactly the replica of the 1986 stage. So that they, you know, if you want to know what to expect, well, have a look at the 1986 stage. Maybe, you know, that it'll give you a clue. You know, the form we've seen Jonas Vingegaard in today. It would be a tremendous surprise not to see him, you know, well, faring well tomorrow. I guess that if Tadej Pogacar wants to strike back, he probably has to wait for the Pyrenees and you know, and take tomorrow as, you know, kind of a recovery day, and to you know, to make his point clear that he's not beaten yet. But you never know.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be an exciting stage regardless. And one thing I did notice with Vingegaard on the final climb is he went really deep. I mean, oftentimes when you see a rider take yellow and, you know, a real GC contender, you see them maybe in a way kind of sail up the climb, and they're you know, they're cruising and they're, you know, really flying up a climb. And, you know, there were times when he was almost wincing. He was closing his eyes and, you know, gritting his teeth. And, you know, I think he knew the significance of taking the jersey and getting time on Pogacar while he can. They have a big day again tomorrow. And you know, one thing actually we mentioned last night, Caleb Ewan. I did speak to Caleb at the finish, and he did come to the finish with his team today, but he mentioned that, you know, the start tomorrow is uphill. They start here in Briançon, and it's the hit from kilometer zero. They start climbing the Col de Lauderay. So it's going to be a stronger breakaway tomorrow, I would imagine. There's no freebies. There's not going to see Matthew Vanderpoel going in the break and then dropping out. You're going to see a really strong breakaway tomorrow, which could be, you know, an exciting day for, you know, the KOM jersey as well.
Well, it's amazing to have so many answers to so many questions on today's stage, and yet to be left with so many questions ready for tomorrow's stage. So I'm gonna say goodbye to you both. So thank you very much, Francois.
Thank you very much, Rose.
And thank you, Ian.
Thank you, Rose.
Before all the rest of you leave, I just want to leave you with today's Tour de Buffalo, and I think we're here on the eve of an Alpe d'Huez stage, and Francois, I'm sure you'll remember this, a moment that, I know that you remember this because you quote it all the time, a moment that I think it's safe to say will go down in cycling podcast history. I'm going to leave you with, on the eve of the Alpe d'Huez stage in 2018, well, Rich giving his predictions for that particular race. I'll leave you with him.
The Tour du Buffalo, remembering Richard Moore.
We had a bit of a discussion on the way down the hill in the car about Team Sky and about Geraint Thomas and Chris Froome, because for me, there isn't really a hint of any kind of friction between them. Partly that's their personalities, and partly I think there'll be an honesty to what happens. It'll be about whoever's going best. The one thing that I've sort of discounted is if Geraint Thomas is really going better than Chris Froome over 3 weeks, and Froome has to make way for Geraint Thomas. But I don't really see that happening. I mean, I think it's completely fanciful to think that Geraint Thomas is a potential Tour de France winner. I just don't see it happening.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.